So for today, I thought I would choose a selection from Ajahn Dik Sila Ratano's narrative biography of Meichi Kao. So I'm choosing fairly early section, and so she's not called Meichi Kao yet. She's called Tapai. I don't know if that's correct pronunciation or not. It begins with a quote from Meichi Kao's teaching. So know yourself, accept your faults, and work to overcome them. Hide nothing from yourself. Above all, don't lie to yourself. You can lie to the entire world if you like, but you must never lie to yourself. So from time to time during the dry and hot seasons of the year, wandering Dutanga monks pass through Ban Hue Sai, searching for secluded places to camp and meditate in solitude. The mountains and forests surrounding the village were areas of vast wilderness, forbidding and inhospitable. Wild animals roamed freely, and malevolent spirits were believed to reign supreme. The terrain remained a jungle, and fear kept it remote and sequestered. This made it an ideal place for wandering meditation monks to live and practice their ascetic way of life in solitude. Detached, reserved, and intent on renunciation, Dutanga monks hiked through the wilderness, often alone, along deserted trails. They sought secluded locations that offered body and mind a calm, quiet setting, a ridge, a cave, an overhanging cliff, places suitable for striving to attain the end of all suffering. Living a life entirely out of doors, the Dutanga monk constantly put himself at the mercy of the elements and the vagaries of the weather. Living in harmony with his natural surroundings, a Dutanga monk's daily life featured nature's rich diversity, rocks and trees, rivers and streams, tigers, snakes, elephants, and bears. For his livelihood, he depended on collecting alms food in the small settlements that had sprung up at the jungle's edge. The Putai felt a common bond with the wandering ascetics and their fearless warrior spirit. Because of that, the monks easily found support for their lifestyle in Putai communities. Tapai's father, Tasson, was especially fond of the forest monks. True sons of the Buddha, he called them, with an appreciative smile. Energized by seeing them, he welcomed their arrival with childlike enthusiasm. In 1914, the arrival of Ajahn Sao Kantasilo, the renowned Dutanga master, transformed the spiritual landscape of Ban Hue Sai, village life forever. Having come from afar, he and a small band of disciples simply wandered into the area on foot one day. They had been hiking for months, first crossing the Mekong River from Lao to Siam's Nakhon Phanom province, then trekking over the eastern hills of Sakhon Nakhon and down through the Phupan wilderness to reach Mukdahan. Though he was 55 years old, Ajahn Sao walked entire days in the tropical heat, crossing the most arduous terrain with steady, effortless steps. When he and his group reached the vicinity of Ban Hue Sai village, the annual rains were just beginning. Cloudbursts and cooling showers were followed by lustrous sunshine illuminating the sky, while damp heat hugged the ground. Ajahn Sao knew that the changing climate beckoned him to search for a suitable site to spend the rains retreat, the annual three-month period of intensive meditation. Following the Buddha's instructions, monks ceased their wandering for the duration of the monsoon season, to reside in one location under the protection of a roof. Ajahn Sao was first spotted in a humid, misty dawn when he entered the sleepy village, leading a column of figures dressed in ochre-colored robes, walking barefoot and with an alms bowl slung across one shoulder. The monks appeared ready to receive what generosity the inhabitants had to offer: rice, pickled fish, bananas, smiles, and respectful bows. Stirred by the monk's serene, dignified appearance, the women, men, and children of the village scrambled to find some food to offer the Dhamma monks, all the while yelling back and forth to one another in their excitement. By the time Ajahn Sao and his monks walked past Tapai's house, her whole family stood expectantly along the dirt track at the front, waiting to place morsels of food in the monks' bowls and hoping to accumulate special merit by their actions. Eager to discover the identity of the newer arrivals, Tapai's father, along with a few friends, followed the monks back to their temporary campsite in the nearby foothills. Although Ajahn Sao was venerated as a supreme master throughout the region, Taisan and his friends had never met him face to face. Surprise turned into joy and excitement when they heard his name mentioned. Tapai's father resolved to have Ajahn Sao settle in the area, if only for the duration of the monsoon season. Well acquainted with the local terrain, fast-flowing streams and winding rivers, overhanging caves and rocky outcrops, open savanna and dense jungle, Taisan acted as a guide to the venerable master, proposing various retreat sites for the coming rains. He was relieved and overjoyed when Ajahn Sao chose to enter the retreat at Bang Lang Cave, situated in a forested area scattered with flat, outspread sandstone boulders about an hour's walk from the village. Long before their introduction to Buddhism, the Putai people upheld an ancient tradition of ritual spirit worship. They paid obeisance and performed sacrifices to benevolent and ancestral spirits and to the guardian spirits of the forests. Ancestor worship was so ingrained in their character that the spirit shrine became a central feature of home life. Families presented daily oblations to placate long-dead forebears, actions believed to protect the family, the house, even the village from unpleasant occurrences, including the unpleasant consequences of neglecting that sacred duty. If things went well, that meant the spirits were happy with the family's efforts. Neglecting the rituals displeased the spirits, which accounted for why things went wrong. Auspicious days were sought for the start of every endeavor, and propitiatory offerings were made to win the favor of local deities. The deities of earth and sky were not omitted. Due to an intimate association with rice and water, the Putai inherited an age-old saying, "In eating, don't forget the rice field spirit, and never overlook the water spirit that brings us fish." So while the center of each village featured Buddhist temple or wat, spirit worship still dominated a major portion of the villagers' lives. For years, Ajahn Sao wandered through the countryside, enlightening the locals about the virtues of moral behavior and explaining the causal consequences of their actions and beliefs. Ajahn Sao did not deny the existence of spirits and deities. They abided everywhere, in everything: forests, trees, mountains, caves, rivers, fields, earth, and sky. And he was tolerant of belief in non-physical existence. What he opposed was the belief that such entities were the causes, the instigators of human pain and suffering, and the belief that bribes of sacrificial offerings could guard against adversity and misfortune. Local deities and ghosts were as much a part of the Putai village life as the sun, the rain, and the morning fog, as inescapable as birth, life, and death. This Ajahn Sao did not refute, but he taught them that every non-physical being experienced the karmic consequences of its own actions. Each was the product of its own karma, just like the villagers themselves. Worshipping these beings was, in effect, attributing to them a power that they did not possess. The essence of Ajahn Sao's message was personal responsibility. Pleasure or pain, happiness or suffering, having or lacking, all are a result of an individual's past karmic deeds, combined with one's moral behavior in the present. Preparing Ajahn Sao's encampment for the retreat required the construction of shelters to weather the monsoon rains, a single-room hut for each monk, and a central sala for meals and recitations of the monastic rules. Paths for walking meditation needed leveling, and latrines needed digging. With joy in his heart and a bounce in his step, Tapai's father quickly volunteered his services, cutting and sawing trees for stout posts, splitting and pressing bamboo for floors and walls, collecting and binding tall grasses for roof thatching. Paths were cleared, graded, and swept. Outdoor toilets were excavated and encircled with thatch. By the time Taisan and his friends completed the work, a small, orderly forest monastery had been crafted from the jungle wilderness. Spiritual transformation happened gradually for the Putai village. First one family, then another, took the leap of faith. Faith in the protective power of the Lord Buddha and faith in their own moral virtue. Many burned their spirit shrines and objects of ritual worship to ashes. Some were skeptical of Buddhism and hesitated. Who knew how the local deities would react? Might they not take revenge? Naturally frugal with speech, Ajahn Sao used his words sparingly to counter common fears and inculcate faith and virtue among the villagers. In talks that were direct and easy to understand, he taught them simple lessons. To instill faith, he encouraged them to replace the custom of sacrificial offerings with the practice of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. To inculcate virtue, he encouraged them to observe the five moral precepts, refraining from killing, stealing, lying, committing adultery, and taking intoxicants. The villagers learned that by guarding their minds and actions with simple yet potent practices and thus avoiding behavior harmful to themselves and others, they would acquire the means to protect themselves. So as to help them overcome and rid themselves of fear, Ajahn Sao taught them the protective power of meditation. First, he guided people in paying homage to the Buddha by chanting the Blessed One's virtues in unison. Once their hearts were calm and clear, he proceeded to lay their doubts and worries, speaking simply and concisely. Don't be afraid. As long as you meditate, focusing on Buddho, 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 the spirits will never disturb you. Everyone falls ill at some point in life, but it's nonsense to think that sickness is caused by ghosts and spirits. Our bodies are constantly decaying or renewing themselves. The human body and illness go hand in hand. It's pointless to ask your dead relatives for help. Far better that you practice meditation and dedicate the merit of your actions to their spirits. Then you both will gain some benefit. As custom dictated, the villagers, especially devout Buddhists, reserved part of each lunar observance day for religious activities. They went to the monastery to offer food, help with the chores, listen to Dhamma teachings, practice meditation, or undertake a combination of these activities. Tapai, now 13 years old, often accompanied her parents on early morning hikes to the forest monastery at Banglang Cave. Being a girl, however, she was not allowed to mingle with the monks. So when Ajahn Sao spoke to the lay people, Tapai sat far in the back of the sala, just within earshot of his soft, mellow voice. Seated behind the women and peering over her stepmother's shoulder, Tapai absorbed the atmosphere and the teachings. She, like all the villagers, had inherited the local cultural beliefs as a matter of course. Her worldview was colored by the same historical background. Yet, though she knew of the existence of spirits since early childhood, Tapai was not a superstitious person. She preferred instead to seek cause and effect relationships by means of common sense. So while her family kept a small shrine honoring the spirits, Tapai's natural inclination was to embrace the Buddha and the truth of his teaching. Thus, from an early age, Tapai felt the lasting influence of Ajahn Sao. She responded to his simple, down-to-earth manner, his even, serene temperament, and his noble and dignified appearance. He inspired a deep devotion in her and left an indelible impression with his character, his words, his very presence. Even though she did not really make an effort to focus her mind in meditation as he instructed, Tapai sensed in her that Ajahn Sao had attained perfect peace. Soon, Tapai felt the subtle force of Ajahn Sao's personality pulling her in a new direction. She first felt this pull on one memorable occasion. She heard Ajahn Sao praise the women folk for their generous support of the monks. Their daily offerings of food and other necessities were not only beneficial to the monks, but they were also a blessing for their own futures as well. He then added, briefly and emphatically, that the virtue of generosity was nothing compared to the virtue of renunciation practiced by white-robed nuns meditating in the forest. This remark stirred Tapai at the core of her being. The nuns, said Ajahn Sao, were a fruitful field of merit for all living beings. With that pointed pronouncement, Ajahn Sao had planted a small seed in the young girl's heart that would one day grow into a majestic Bodhi tree. Ajahn Sao spent 3 years living in the vicinity of Ban Hue Sai village, first in one forest location, then in another. By the time he departed Kam Chai district and wandered north, the religious landscape in the area had been altered for good. So influential was Ajahn Sao that most of the locals now favored Buddhist practices over spirit worship. Tapai's father had accompanied Ajahn Sao as he moved to different places in the area, suggesting new secluded spots and working with his friends to construct small bamboo shelters for him and his disciples. As much as anyone, he was pleased by the Buddhist renaissance spreading through the community. While Tapai's father was saddened to see Ajahn Sao leave, he was simultaneously consoled by his knowledge that Buddhism was now firmly established in the hearts and minds of his Putai neighbors. Little did he suspect, though, that Ajahn Sao's departure would be succeeded by the arrival of the most revered Buddhist master of them all. Ajahnmun Buridatta was a legend in the making. The story of his life and spiritual attainments were to gain an exalted status unparalleled in modern Thai history. Already a sterling reputation had reached the northeastern provinces, passed on by word of mouth throughout the region. It was said that he expounded the profound nature of Dhamma with such power and persuasion that even the spirits were subdued in his presence. Devas, Nagas, Garudas, and Asuras were all captivated by the aura of his abiding love and compassion. His austere way of life had made him a master of the ascetic, a pioneer of the Dutanga lifestyle. His disciples, the monks who lived by his example, had become his legion, and he guided them with the uncompromising discipline of a consummate spiritual warrior. It was rumored that by meeting Ajahnmun only once, one would be bestowed with a lifetime of good fortune. A true wanderer, Ajahnmun rarely stayed in the same location for more than one rains retreat. After the rains ended, he and his monks roamed freely, unburdened, through the vast northeastern wilderness, like birds at ease, flying peacefully to wherever the wind took them. And like birds who soar freely and are content to land in a tree, pond, or marsh, then to fly off and leave all behind with no lingering attachment, so too did Dutanga monks lead lives of sublime detachment. Thus, in 1917, as the annual monsoon season was fast approaching, Ajahnmun and a group of 60 monks wandered down from the north to arrive in the wooded foothills overlooking the village of Ban Hue Sai. They camped under trees and caves, under overhanging cliffs and nearby charnel grounds. Following Ajahn Sao's groundbreaking path into the Ban Hue Sai community, Ajahnmun's arrival caused a stir of excitement. The villagers were thrilled with the prospect of making merit by supporting monks. The entire village of Ban Hue Sai welcomed the Dhamma monks with faith and gratitude. Ajahnmun and his disciples took up their practice in their new surroundings, living simply and practicing meditation in the Dutanga tradition. Many villagers flocked to the hillside encampment on lunar observance days, and Tapai's parents made sure to join them. At that time, Tapai was hardly aware of Ajahnmun's distinguished reputation. She had heard his name mentioned in connection with Ajahn Sao. The two had long been close spiritual companions, supporting and encouraging each other in the way of practice. That much Tapai knew, but little else. Accompanying her parents from time to time, she noticed differences between Ajahnmun and Ajahn Sao. She saw at once that Ajahnmun's forceful, dynamic character contrasted sharply with Ajahn Sao's serene and even temperament. Physically, Ajahnmun was shorter and more slender than Ajahn Sao. But when he spoke, he was much more active. His arms flew, his hands gestured dramatically, and his voice thundered. Tapai felt a little afraid of Ajahnmun at first, a little wary of his intensity. In the village each morning, as she placed offerings of food in his alms bowl, Ajahnmun frequently stopped and addressed her directly, encouraging her to come see him more often. But feeling shy and timid in his presence, Tapai only dared to go on special religious days when she was with her parents and a group of the local villagers. Ajahnmun was always exceptionally kind to her, often recognizing her presence on observance days and exchanging a few words with her. Knowing intuitively that she possessed uncommon spiritual potential and deep devotion, he began encouraging her to do meditation. He explained to her the same basic technique that Ajahn Sao had taught, silent repetition of the meditation word Buddho, practiced repeatedly and continuously until it became the sole object of her awareness. He emphasized that mindfulness, being mindful and aware only of the moment-to-moment recitation of each syllable, Buddho, Buddho, must be present to direct her efforts. It would make her alert and fully attentive to the rise and fall of each repetition. A simple method, she thought, but due to instinctive modesty, she hesitated taking it up at first. As Ajahnmun repeatedly insisted that she try meditation practice, Tapai began to suspect that she must possess some inherent ability. She thought to herself, "I am just an ordinary village girl, but I must have some inherent virtue. Why else would he show such an interest in me? From now on, I should take his advice and try to practice meditation the way he has so kindly taught me." One evening after dinner, Tapai readied herself and went to her bedroom early. All day she had felt a willful determination welling up inside her heart. Today was the day to focus her full attention on the repetition of Buddho, just as Ajahnmun had taught her. With devotion and a serious sense of purpose, Tapai began to mentally repeat the meditation word Buddho. After about 15 minutes of steady, deliberate recitation, her conscious mind suddenly dropped down to her heart and converged into a profound state of quiet stillness. It was as though she had instantly fallen to the bottom of a well, where her body and mind vanished into silence. The experience was so new and so extraordinary that she had no idea what had happened to her. After a brief time, her mind withdrew slightly from deep samadhi, and she became uncomfortably aware of an image of her body lying dead in front of her. She recognized her own corpse very clearly. The image was so real and so vivid and detailed that it convinced her that she must have died. Suddenly, seemingly out of nowhere, an anxious thought ruffled the calm. "Since I'm dead, who will take my place cooking rice to put into the monks' bowls tomorrow? Who's going to tell Ajahn Mun that I died sitting in meditation tonight?" Quickly suppressing these worries, Tapai steadied her mind and accepted her fate. She mused, "If I'm dead, I'm dead. Everyone in the world is bound to die. Nobody can escape from death. Even a great king must die one day." Her mind then became resolute and focused as she fixed her attention to the dead body lying prostrate before her. The image had not faded or changed in the least, which reinforced her impression that she was actually dead. As she pondered the consequences of her death without reaching any conclusions, a small group of local villagers appeared in her vision. They simply materialized in the pictures, slowly picked up her limp, lifeless body, and carried it to a nearby charnel ground. As the villagers laid her body in the middle of the desolate area, she noticed Ajahn Mun and a group of monks solemnly walking toward the corpse. Ajahn Mun stopped in front of it and gazed down for a moment before turning to the monks to say, "This girl is dead. Now I'll perform the funeral rites." As the monks looked on impassively, heads slightly bowed, Ajahn Mun softly intoned the funeral chant, "Anicca Vata Sankara." And quote, "When the components that make up the body have died, the body is no longer of use. The heart, however, does not die. It goes on working ceaselessly. When it develops in the way of virtue, its benefits are unlimited. But if it is used in harmful ways, it becomes a danger to oneself." With calm deliberation, Ajahn Mun slowly repeated this dictum three times in succession, standing tall and perfectly still except for the movement of his arms. He tapped her corpse three times with his walking stick, declaring with each tap, "The body does not last. Having been born, it must die. The heart, however, does last. It is never born, and it does not die when the body dies. It is constantly in motion, spinning and shifting, following the causes and conditions that lead it on." Continuing to tap the corpse rhythmically with the tip of his walking stick, Ajahn Mun appeared to reiterate this truth over and over again. With each gentle tap of his stick, her body started to decompose. First, the skin blistered and peeled, exposing the flesh beneath. Further tapping rotted the flesh and sinews, revealing the bones and inner organs. Entranced, Tapai watched passively as her entire body quickly decayed, until only the hard bones remained intact. Placing his hand in the skeletal debris and picking up the kernel of the heart in his palm, Ajahn Mun announced, "The heart can never be destroyed. If it were destroyed, you would never regain consciousness." Tapai witnessed the unfolding of the entire scene with a mixture of awe and trepidation. She was not sure how to understand it. When Ajahn Mun finished speaking, she puzzled, "If the whole body decomposes at death, leaving only the bones behind, what is it that regains consciousness?" Still looking at the kernel in his hand and without lifting his gaze, Ajahn Mun immediately answered her thought, "It's bound to return. How could you not regain consciousness when the kernel that brings it back is still there? You will regain consciousness tomorrow morning at dawn." Tapai spent the entire night seated in meditation, completely absorbed in the vision of her dead body. Only at the first light of dawn did her mind withdraw from deep samadhi. As she was becoming aware of herself, she looked down at her body seated on the bed. She realized with a sigh of relief that she had not died. Her normal waking state had returned, and she felt pleased to be alive. But then, as she pondered the night's events, she began to chide herself for falling asleep and dreaming throughout the night when she should have been meditating. She was sure that Ajahn Mun would be disappointed with her. Later in the morning, Ajahn Mun passed by her house on his daily alms round. As Tapai placed food in his alms bowl, he looked at her quizzically. Then he smiled and told her to come see him when he had finished eating. Her father accompanied her on the familiar walk to Ajahn Mun's encampment, unsure why she was asked to go. Could there be a problem? Tipai walked silently, brooding and feeling ashamed of herself for falling asleep in meditation. What was she going to tell Ajahn Mun? Certainly he'd be displeased. She wanted to hide, but she didn't know where or how. As soon as they entered the encampment, Tipai mumbled some excuse to her father and rushed off to help the women folk fetch water at the stream. Seeing Taisan approaching alone, Ajahn Mun looked surprised and asked him for Tipai's whereabouts. Taisan then quickly fetched his daughter from the stream. Nervous and uneasy, Tipai crawled to where Ajahn Mun was seated and bowed down three times before him. Immediately, before she had time to draw a breath, he asked her, "How was your meditation last night?" Timidly and awkwardly, she replied, "It was just hopeless, sir. After repeating Buddho for about 15 minutes, I felt my mind drop down a deep well. After that, I fell asleep and dreamed all night long. When I awoke at dawn, I was so disappointed with my meditation that I still can't get over it. I'm really worried you'll scold me for my lack of effort." Upon hearing this, Ajahn Mun laughed with joy and asked her straight away, "How did you sleep? What did you dream? Please tell me about it." When she told him what had happened, he roared with laughter. Delighted by her story, he said, "That was not sleep. You were not dreaming. What you experienced was the calm, integrated state called samadhi. Remember this well. What you thought was a dream was really a vision arising spontaneously from the deep concentration of samadhi. If you have any further experiences of this kind, just relax, allow them to happen. There's no need to be worried or frightened. I don't want you to be afraid, but you must remain alert and fully aware of whatever takes place in your meditation. As long as I am living here, no harm will come to you. But from now on, please come and tell me about the visions that you experienced in your meditation."
There's that quote at the beginning about not the importance of not lying to oneself. I was just curious about ways to know if you're lying to yourself, and then what to do.
Yeah, well, that's the it's kind of the crux where we sort of like when Ajahn Chah said the fastest way to enlightenment is to just point or look directly at the mind and point your finger and say, "Liar." That's the our minds are constantly spinning out stories and have a and we believe them, and so that the pat answer would be that when suffering arises, then you're really lying. But then it's hard to discern. It's hard to. But I think that's where that sense of reflection and reviewing is so important. Like in the Iddhipadas, the four dhammas leading to success, Channa Viriya Citta Vimoksa. Vimoksa is examination, investigation, but it has a connotation of reviewing. So, reviewing the different moods in the mind, reviewing the different sort of thought patterns, and one of the kind of very simple mantras in meditation, when you hear a thought pattern, a thought coming or something, some kind of a feeling of aversion or some desire, some movement of the mind, and sort of just sort of, really? I found that very helpful, sort of, really? It's just really listening to, is it really what it is? Because the mind, because it, the mind just keeps cranking it out, and it's all very believable. But to really hold up a mirror, hold up a light to it, and oftentimes just that intention of questioning, intention of leaning toward the Dhamma is usually enough to dispel the kind of the habit of the mind, and saying, no, that's not really the case. Okay, let's get back to Dhamma, let's get back to truth.
In like a pictures, photos of Vajramabhua looking very fierce, and also photos of him looking very joyful, laughing. Same with Bhajan Shah,
yeah.
A bit more stern, let's say.
Yeah.
And then also laughing, joyful. Do you think it's fair to say, same could be said for Vajramabhua? Not that there are photos, but there could have been.
Oh yeah, totally. That's the descriptions of Vajramabhua. But there's, there's only, I don't think there's half a dozen photos of Ajahn Mun. And there's only four actual photos of Ajahn Mun. And, and it's sort of like even in the West, when a photograph was taken, it isn't up until fairly modern era, recent modern era, that you didn't pose formally for a photo, and so that's similar in Ajahn Mun's time. He lived during an era where you didn't, a photo was something that you actually posed for formally, and there wasn't such a thing as a kind of informal photograph, and that carried on in Thai culture for much longer than in the West. So it was when, the first informal photograph of a monk, I think, was Ajahn Chah, because of early days of Westerners coming and just sitting underneath Ajahn Chah's kuti and taking photos. And there was this one picture of Ajahn Chah just sort of laughing and it was printed, and it became incredibly popular. And Ajahn Chah he was kind of bemused by it. He said, "Wow, those ferns, they really like teeth." He said. And then over time, there started to be more informal photographs taken of different monks, and you certainly had, Ajahn Mahabhua is sort of the greatest example, because he had probably the biggest reputation for ferocity, you see some of the pictures where he's just incredibly warm, engaging, charming, just laughing and joining himself.
What about Lumpur Doom? Because he looks like pictures of Lumpur Doom. He looks so mellow, to pass the point of being mellow. Was he ever animated?
Animated.
cumbersome.
You see, by the time I met him, he was probably like 80 something. He was quite old when he died. And he was mellow beyond mellow. But even then, you read in that Gifts He Left Behind, there's really kind of nice exchanges where he's got a, I think there's all of them. There's just this, it's hard in the in Thai temperament Thais, just culturally, they really appreciate it. They appreciate a good joke. They appreciate kind of having a good time, and so that even if somebody is extremely mellow and even somewhat severe, they still have that cultural value. They enjoy teasing each other. You see some of these. These old monks together, and it's incredibly sweet sometimes just watching them tease each other.
Did you say that happened? Ajahn Kampong, we went back to...
Oh, that was hilarious. Ajahn Kampong going back from his... it was when I was at Ajahn Jati's, and this past year, the year before. And so Ajahn Kampong had been, and Ajahn Tsokpa had been here, and then it was at Ajahn Jandi's. There's the opening of his sala, and God, there was hundreds of monks, and all the senior monks were there, and sitting around having breakfast in the morning, and all of these senior monks are there. It's all very informal. There's teasing back and forth, and then Ajahn Kampong, I came in, and then Ajahn Kampong starts to sort of say something about, good to see you, and then he's talking about it. He said something about his trip to America, and then a whole bunch of the monks started to, we've all heard about his trip to America. Every time he gets up on the Dhamma seat, all he can talk about is his trip to America. And then they sort of tell him about this. So they were just teasing him relentlessly. It was really fun to watch. Because Ajahn Kampong is such a gregarious person as well. So there, it's very sweet.
When Ajahn Tsokpa was, or Lumbar Tsokpa was here, Ajahn Kampong was sitting there and they were speaking Thai, and Ajahn Sanyo translated what they said to me. Kampong said, I just keep getting fatter and fatter, and I don't know what to do. And Lumbar Tsokpa looks at me and said, yeah, there's causes and conditions. You keep filling your bowl with dessert, you're going to get fatter. Kind of obvious, isn't it? Causes conditions. You're fat. And I just was laughing.